Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The United States is mired in a healthcare crisis, separate from the COVID pandemic. Our healthcare system, which is largely for profit, leaves many Americans without adequate coverage. It doesn't even perform better, as demonstrated by high rates of infant mortality and low life expectancy for Americans. I spoke about this with author Tom Hartman, who has what he describes as a simple solution for our healthcare problems, Medicare for all. Tom is a trained psychotherapist and a New York Times best-selling author of 32 books. He has a popular progressive talk radio show, also simulcast on TV, in approximately 60 million North American homes. Tom has written multiple books in the Hidden History series, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment and The Hidden History of the War on Voting. His next book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. We are lucky to have him on our program today.
Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you. It's great talking to you again.
Tom, why did you write this book as part of your Hidden History series, and why now?
Right now, I think healthcare is probably more top of mind for a lot of people than any other time in our recent history, because we're experiencing a pandemic, and in the midst of this, we've got, you know, 30 or 40 million people who are under or uninsured, arguably, you know, well over 100 million people underinsured. And we're seeing bankruptcies from people getting sick just skyrocketing. They had been averaging around a half a million a year for the last couple of decades. And last year they were over 700,000. This year they'll be over a million. And these are mostly people who got sick with COVID and as a consequence have huge hospital bills or doctor bills that they can't pay and their insurance companies are only covering parts of. So I think that it's a really critical time to be having a conversation about how we reinvent our healthcare system so that it actually serves everybody in the country rather than just, you know, a few billionaires in the health insurance industry.
Did I correctly read that in the U.S. we have the worst of all worlds, healthcare that's more expensive and less effective, especially in terms of life expectancy?
That's true. That's absolutely true. And in fact, in terms of things like maternal mortality or child mortality, we are in third world category. We're below, I believe, all other developed countries. Possible there's one that we're competing with in those categories. The only area, which, by the way, is the area that you will find all over the internet being held up as proof that American healthcare is wonderful. The only area where we do better than most other countries in the world is breast cancer. And the only reason for that has nothing to do with our health insurance system or our medical care system. It has to do with the absolute extraordinary efforts over a period of about a decade and a half, two decades, of a group of very, very committed women raising consciousness about breast cancer and particularly teaching women how to do self-exam. So that's the one area in healthcare where we're doing well, and that's because of early diagnosis. But in every other realm, we pay anywhere from a third to twice as much, a third more to twice as much for health insurance and healthcare in general as any other country in the world. We pay about twice as much for pharmaceuticals as any other country in the world. And the average American family spends about $3,000 a year on healthcare that no other, you know, it's basically a tax that is not hit, that doesn't hit the residents of any other developed country in the world.
So I'm hoping you'll help us by defining a phrase you like and which our listeners have heard mentioned by some progressive political candidates. What exactly is Medicare for all?
Well, Medicare is a single-payer healthcare system. The single payer is the government. And all the bills come to one source, and that one source pays all the bills. Medicare, as it was put into place in the 1966 or 67, 65, I forget which year it was, but you know, when Medicare was put into place, was designed, Robert Ball, the guy who actually wrote the Medicare legislation, designed it so that with just literally changing a few sentences, it could become a national healthcare system, much like Canada had at that time. Canada's was called Medicare. It started in one province, Saskatchewan. Other provinces wanted it. They got it. Eventually, the federal government stepped in to backstop the individual provinces. My guess is that's probably how it's going to play out here in the United States. Right now, there is a law that prevents that from happening that both California and Vermont have passed single-payer legislation, but they haven't been able to implement it because if a state does that right now under current law, all Medicaid and Medicare money stops coming into the state, or at least the state can't reallocate it through their system. And that is a small change to law that has been proposed year after year after year by Democrats and progressives in Congress. And of course, the health insurance industry is fighting it tooth and nail. But, you know, that's what it is, single payer health care. And hopefully that's how we'll get it.
So that leads into the next question. Is the term Medicare for All completely synonymous with single payer health care, or is it one system that you are in favor of?
Well, it depends on whose definition you're using. Medicare itself is a single payer system, but it only pays 80% of expenses. That was put into place in the 60s. It was a demand made by white racist Southern senators who did not want black people to have access to health care. Racism has been the principal animating force behind our lack of a comprehensive health care system in this country for over 100 years, as I document fairly exhaustively in the book. These white senators from the South wanted to make sure that if a poor black person got sick, which was the majority of black people at that time in the South, then they wouldn't be able to afford the copay, so they wouldn't go get care. And this goes back to the scientific racism theories of Frederick Hoffman, who toured the United States in the late 1800s and early 20th century, pitching his idea that if we simply denied health care to black people, they were so genetically inferior, they would all eventually die out. And that animated the AMA, that animated our policy, that became part of the reason why there's this 20% hole in Medicare in the 1960s. So if you really wanted it to be single payer, you have to do away with that 20% hole and have Medicare pay all expenses and then extend it to everybody in the country, which is, by the way, what is being proposed by the people who are the advocates of Medicare for All. But if we were to simply take our current Medicare system with its 20% hole, where you have to buy a private health insurance policy if you're over 65 to supplement, you know, it's called Medigap, to fill that gap, to supplement your Medicare policy, then I'm not quite sure you could call it single payer. It would be more like that's American Medicare. But like I said, Canada calls their single payer system Medicare, as do other countries. Pretty straightforward stuff.
Thanks. Have there been any serious previous efforts to develop Medicare for All?
There have been a bunch of previous efforts. Teddy Roosevelt pitched this in 1912. Franklin Roosevelt pitched it in 1936. Harry Truman pitched it in 1947. John Kennedy pitched it in 1961. In every case, the majority of the pushback that they got came from the insurance industry and from the white racist, mostly in the South, who did not want black people to have equal access to health care and were afraid that a national health care system would integrate the hospitals and doctor's offices, which was something they were able to succeed in preventing right up until the 1960s. So although Medicare has been the most successful racial integration program in history, in less than 1 year, we integrated every hospital in America simply because those were the terms under which they would get the money. But, you know, we need to clean this up and tweak it a little better.
So I actually practiced cancer medicine in Canada for years, and I thought it was pretty wonderful. But people here always point to the, oh, there are no blankets in hospitals, or say it takes 5 years to get a shoulder MRI under single-payer coverage. Do you think there truly are disadvantages like that with Medicare for All?
I think with any kind of medical system, you're going to have a difficult time load balancing supply and demand. When Louise and I moved to Washington, D.C. back about 12 years ago, we literally could not find a doctor in D.C., and Louise needed to get some medication that she needs to take on a daily basis. And every single medical practice, I mean, we called everybody. Louise spent days on the phone trying to find a doctor. Every doctor was filled up. I know when I needed back surgery, I had to jump through a whole lot of hoops and had to wait quite a while to get that back surgery. With Louise in D.C., we ended up going to a concierge practice, where you pay the doctor up front, you pay him a couple $1,000 a year just to be your doctor. And then you go see them and they send you another bill, which is, by the way, spreading all across the United States now, because we have these huge shortages. We have areas in this country where there are doctor shortages, or at least GP shortages. There are other places where there's shortages in particular specialties. A national healthcare system will substantially ameliorate that, and stopping the cap on the number of people who can go to medical school in order to just, you know, artificially inflate the pay of docs is probably also a useful thing to do in the United States. So right now, as anybody who has had, you know, elective surgery can tell you, there are long waits, or there can be long waits in the United States. depending on the policy you have, depending on the part of the country you live in, and depending on, you know, how much money you're willing to kick in, or, you know, if you're willing to go to a place that charges a premium that you may have to pay. That's not a system that is lacking in allocations or lacking in rationing, which is the word that they love to use. They say, oh, they ration Canada, ration healthcare in Canada. Well, we ration healthcare here in the United States. We just do it based on ability to pay rather than severity of medical condition. And I think severity of medical condition is really the appropriate point where you say, okay, you know, this person has, you know, a cancer at risk of metastasis. We're going to take that out tomorrow. Or this person has a broken bone. We're going to fix it this afternoon. Whereas that person has some arthritis in their hip, and sometime in the next year or two, they're going to need a hip replacement. Let's put that off 3 months before we start doing the preliminary work. That just makes sense to me.
Certainly everybody who needed frontline chemotherapy for colorectal cancer in Canada got it, which was wonderful for practitioners and for the patients.
Louise and I lived for 10 years or so in Vermont, you know, right across the border from Canada. And there were not all kinds of Canadians coming to America looking for medical care. In fact, I never saw one. But every weekend in Montpelier, Vermont, where we lived, a bus would pull into the center of town, and older people, people on Medicare mostly, would fill the bus, and it would drive up north to Toronto to go to the pharmacies for people to pick up their prescriptions. We have such a dysfunctional system here. It's just shocking.
You compare taxes used to pay for health care to taxes that might be used to fund a fire department, for example. Do you think that argument resonates with opponents?
Well, I don't know about opponents. I'm not sure that any argument resonates with them. And this is a conversation that we haven't had in a big way in the United States really since the 1950s. And we really first started having in an honest way in the 1880s and 1890s when we went from private fire departments that only put out the fire on your house if you had their medallion on the front of your house, meaning you'd paid your fee to them every year, and private police departments in many parts of the country, and no public schools of any consequence, to by 1900, public schools being a thing that had spread out of Boston in the 1890s and across the country within a decade or two. And we kind of all agreed that, you know, if your house is on fire, that's everybody's problem. That's a community problem. It's bigger than something you can individually deal with. Therefore, dealing with houses on fire should be considered part of the commons. If you've got a child that needs an education, that's something that's beyond the capability of most individuals, particularly if they have to work a job, and there's benefit to the entire community. So that's appropriately part of the commons being the things that we all collectively own and administer and fund. And I would say, you know, if we've agreed for 100 years now that if your house is on fire, we will all collectively pay to get a fire department and a fire truck out there. Isn't your body as valuable as a house? If your body is metaphorically on fire with, you know, cancer or disease or injury, isn't that as urgent a consideration as somebody's house being on fire? It certainly seems that way to me. And I think now is the time to start saying healthcare should be part of our commons, just like fire and police are, and schools.
I think that leads beautifully to another question. You had a big chapter title with a big concept, healthcare, right or privilege. I think I can guess your answer, but would you like to explain it?
Well, that is really what it comes down to. I mean, in the United States, you have a right to an education. If your child is not, if you feel that your child is not being appropriately educated in school, you can literally sue the government. There are areas where we have very specific rights that we can enforce in court, but healthcare is not one of them, which, you know, as I said, I think is crazy. Healthcare has been defined as a right by the United Nations. We signed that treaty defining it as a right. We just never applied it to our own country. Healthcare is defined as a right by 33 out of the 34 OECD countries, the richest countries in the world, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. We are the only one that doesn't recognize healthcare as a right. And I think that's morally criminal and, you know, and a tragedy at a societal and a personal level. And really only serves to benefit the people who are just getting obscenely rich running these health insurance industry scams from Medicare Advantage on down to private health insurance.
Thanks. You had so many astonishing percentages and other figures. You said that 80% of Americans would have to borrow or beg for cash if they were hit with an unexpected, simple $1,000 expense. That scares me, and I presume our listeners. Can you explain how single-payer health care or Medicare for All help Americans avoid a financial crisis?
Well, it pays the bills. I mean, it's very straightforward. In some countries, you have medical or healthcare systems where there's a small deductible. You know, we may have that here, but right now, most Americans have health insurance policies that have deductibles and copays and whatnot that add up to multiple thousands of dollars a year. And in a country where 80% of the country can't deal with a $1,000 expense, half of the country can't deal with a $400 expense, that's just not sustainable.
So getting down to the nitty-gritty, you had a pretty radical-sounding solution. Have the government buy the insurance companies. How would that work? How would that help?
Well, one of the problems that we have right now is the Supreme Court has ruled on multiple occasions, Citizens United is the most well-known one, that if a corporation or a billionaire want to massively influence politics or even own a politician, that's not called corruption or bribery, that's called free speech. And it's protected by the First Amendment. As a consequence of that, when you try to take on a giant industry like the health insurance industry, or in this, the one that's playing out right in front of us right now is pharmaceuticals. You've got AARP saying, let's let the government negotiate drug prices for Medicare. And you've got the drug companies running ads on TV right now saying, whoa, if you let that happen, then we're not going to be able to get drugs to people on Medicare, which is just complete BS. So if they're or when there is a serious attempt to create Medicare for All, you can bet that this industry, where you've got a handful of companies, six, eight companies that are showing billion-dollar quarterly profits, multi-billion-dollar quarterly profits, who are paying hundreds of executives more than $1 million a year. These people will invest a few hundred million dollars, or maybe even $1 billion, in a nationwide ad campaign to take down any effort to do this. They did it back when Obama was doing Obamacare. They did it against Hillary Clinton back in 93. They will launch war. If you add up the market capitalization of the five or six largest health insurance companies, it comes to just a little over $1 trillion. By recollection, it's in the book. You've read it more recently. I wrote it a year ago. But it's about $1.1 trillion, something like that. If we just bought all their stock and said, okay, we own you now, and then just started retiring them and, you know, closing down their operations and moving it all over to Medicare and reallocating those employees, it may be a kind of a bloodless coup, as it were. It might be a lot more effective than trying to go to war with them and just drive them out of business.
What can supporters practically do to make Medicare for All happen?
Let your elected officials know that you support it, both at the local level, because I believe a lot of these initiatives are really going to start at the state level. So your state representative and your state senator or assembly person or whatever it may be. And then also let your one member of the House of Representatives and your two senators know. You know, we're very fortunate here in Oregon. You know, I'm represented by Earl Blumenauer, and of course, we've got Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley in the Senate. And they are all advocates of single payer. I know that we have, you know, one Democrat who we're not really sure of, but we'll see. You know, we'll see. But we just need to let people know that this is a priority for us.
Importantly, where can readers find a copy of your book?
Any bookstore, any online source. It's distributed through all the normal channels.
Tom, do you have any final thoughts or items we didn't cover that you'd like to?
You know, Rahm Emanuel famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Here we have this crisis caused by a pandemic, and it's causing people, I think many people for the first time, to realize that personal health and public health are interrelated. We need it. We need Medicare for All or single-payer health care now more than ever.
Tom, I want to thank you so much for being on KBOO News and Bits.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today we spoke with Tom Hartmann, author of The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. Powell's Books is hosting an event to help launch the book at 5 p.m. Thursday, September 9th. The virtual event is free to attend. You can find more information and register at powells.com/events-update. In the book, Tom described the deplorable state of American healthcare and outlined his fix, Medicare for All. I was particularly struck by a phrase on his website. It is time for America to join every industrialized country in the world to make health a right, not a privilege. Let's hope that happens. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Josh Salem. Thanks for listening.